Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books. And today I am speaking to Phil Campbell about his book Grassroots in paperback, which has also been made into a movie, which I presume made slightly more money than the book from what I know of his publisher. For due diligence here, I share the publisher who has published two of my own books. So I know this is no way to riches and retirement. Now, Phil, your book is very political on one level. It's about election campaign in Seattle, which is sort of sounds like it sounds like Greenwich Village transposed into wet and trees in the cast of characters. You know, frankly, you could read this as either a memoir or a novel or some creative synthesis of the two. So how would you categorize it?
Well, I mean, for starters, I think it's political, but it also, I mean, it's interesting because it cuts both ways. I found that some conservative friends of mine who read it and weren't, you know, put off by it either. So, but at the same time, the characters, because it has novelistic qualities, it moves you forward. So, you know, what I tried to do is put myself in the story of a guy who got fired from his job at The Stranger, the alternative weekly out there, sort of, you know, flopped around not knowing what to do with his life. I was 28 at the time, and ended up getting involved in my friend's political campaign for city council, local city council race, which doesn't sound very exciting, book material. But the guy, it was a fascinating guy, and there was a lot of once you get into it, it feels like there's a lot at stake. The person, the candidate was Grant Cogswell, and he's sort of an anarchist, civic activist. He's a poet a romantic who's got the tattoo of the city logo on his arm. He loves the city so much he was going to defend it, and there are all these high ideals that were there. And so, you know, both the book and the movie really try to go for a feel of the city and just, you know, being a local person, you know, just, you know, trying to make the best out of what you can and through politics. And so, you know, some of the politics that are in there, they're very lefty, but a lot of the things that we were going for actually were fiscally sound too, about mass transit issues. So I don't think it turns off anybody of any political stripe, because it is a good story about running a campaign, doing your best, and kind of running up against what when you're young and have no money and you're going against the incumbent who has the money, who has all the endorsements, just how frustrating that can be. So there's a lot of different elements in there. There's also a story, a subplot of a housemate who wants, you know, has a little political motivation in his own mind to oust me as the house manager in the shared housing situation that we're in. So it's a very Seattle story of the shared housing environment too, that gets kind of quirky and almost Seinfeld-esque about, you know, this petty squabbles of shared housing.
Well, yeah, that occurred to me. It was a great subplot, sort of.
The movie, they took it out and replaced it with a romantic thing to make a love triangle with me and my character, who's played by Jason Biggs and Kobe Smulders. She's an activist, and she was really funny because Kobe Smulders play in reality. That's the man is a 50-year-old activist, and I would never have sex with that guy. But I just with Kobe Smulders, you know, they throw that throw that in, as well as a girlfriend who became me later in reality and in the book became. I got engaged to became my wife.
I was, especially in the early parts of the book, I was a bit worried about the relative. It's what definitely made it more memoirish is the fact that you did not really develop on the girlfriend. She sort of tended to be in the background, I presume, for reasons of discretion.
Excuse me. She told me not to put her in the book, that's why.
Well, that's precisely what I was trying to elicit from you, I guess.
She didn't want to be in any part of it, so I was going to, but she's like, no, I don't want to be in it. So, you know, if you're sticking with a long-term relationship, I had to honor that. But, you know, the basic story is more of a political coming-of-age story anyway, and it's just these ideals, and, you know, just you can do it without – not every story needs a love story, so it was fine without it, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, you know, having been involved in politics myself for many years, the minutiae of the campaign are actually quite fascinating. You know, how to leaflet buses, how to stick up yard signs on the fly.
That's it. Yeah, they really wanted to capture that small, the minutiae, like you say, of like how this stuff is done, and within the framework of plot and action. So it not, and it was actually carried out in some of it very, you know, interesting ways, because yard signing and putting up yard signs along the highway in Seattle is a misdemeanor. You're not supposed, you get fined for it. And so we were out there in a Volvo with a car full of like 100 yard signs, and, you know, running around, and one of the guys who was with me was doing drugs. I mean, it was like, it was, you know, the guy was, you know, I think he was on meth. I mean, it was just like, it took me by surprise to tell me that in the middle of it. We were just sort of, it was a middle of the night sort of caper kind of thing. But here is a very, what every candidate does every, you know, every election cycle.
Yeah, and I mean, I've been out fly posting myself late at night, and I remember one particularly inauspicious campaign where one of the veterans, we were running out of paste, and he decided to improvise on the only liquid available. But I told him, well, you can put the bloody posters up on. After he had filled up the bucket with paste, and the big guy was slightly yellow.
Oh my!
That's what we always do.
Well, that's DIY, you know. That's as do-it-yourself as you can get.
So, I mean, what are the issues? It seems to be sort of fairly esoteric. There's the council. You know, normally in this great world of binary American politics, you're for public transit or you're against public transit. But you're getting into some sort of theological niceties here about light rail versus monorail.
Yeah, exactly, and it's Seattle too. So everybody has a very, and it was a part of the aspect of Seattle that was kind of frustrating for me, because I kind of like more diverse environments, and here I was among all the sort of nice, you know, more affluent liberals, and everybody on the surface agreed with everything. So it got some of the conversations got a little Jesuitical about, you know, like how to approach things, because allegedly we all agreed. So, you know, this was actually a campaign of mass transit, one brand of mass transit versus another. And it happened, as it happened, that we were running a campaign for monorail, which, you know, has this idea, the ideal of it being it's above the ground, it's above the surface, and it's very quiet, and it's not on the streets. You really wouldn't be able to do subway. It would have been for Seattle. It's too expensive and hilly and all of that. So, you know, it was a surface train versus, you know, a monorail, which can be above the streets and not, you know, threaten anybody's lives, because you're not having street crossings and all of that stuff. So these were specific arguments, and that was a challenge to sort of tell this story and make it riveting. And I actually saved the sort of policy issues for like chapter 6 or 7, and you know, front loaded the book with stories about Grant Cogswell and his romanticism, and you know, these ideas, me getting fired and that desperation of like just being an unemployed person with no money, you know. So setting those characters up first before you got wonky with, mass transit versus mass transit.
I would say, from this distance, and speaking as somebody who supports mass transit and tends to see the issue as whether you have it or not, not what form of it. It sort of lended to the wackiness that people would get so sort of uptight about the forms of it. It's sort of, you know, it's a bit like one of the 57 varieties of Trotskyist. What the hell are they arguing about?
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, here in America, I mean, it feels like, you know, at this point, and like New York has got great mass transit, and D.C. has got some good, you know, like not many cities have good mass transit. So if, you know, this kind of argument in other places, it's like, what are you guys talking about? One or the other? Just pick, you know, like it'd be awesome to have anything.
A bus would be a big step forward.
A bus to function. I've lived in Memphis. I've lived in Ohio. I've lived in Kentucky. I mean, these places were, you know, you had to have a car. That was it. So, yeah, I know. And then that was the kind of thing. This is like this book has an only in Seattle flavor, which I think deepens the story a little bit, makes the local more, you know, by just getting into it as deeply as you can, makes it real for the reader.
Yeah, I totally appreciate that, because quite often American editors and filmmakers tend to be they bland everything down. They think that local references spoil it, and they try to sort of Americanize or universalize, whereas, you know, I think the strength of some of these of stories is their locality. If you think of things like Shallow Grave or those sort of Grand Guignol Scots and British movies, you need to have people killing each other in Scots accents to get the whole thing.
I never thought about that. Yeah, I've lived in a lot of small towns in other places, like, you know, Memphis. I've lived in, you know, I've lived around a lot of places in America, but not much abroad. So I do have a real, like, regionalism in those, the nuances of what happens when you live in Ohio, when you say one thing versus what the saying the same thing in the South, what that'll do and what kind of reaction that'll get. I'm kind of obsessed with those kinds of things. So I totally agree. I love the stories that get personal and local and give you a feel for place.
Yeah. Oh, My Cousin Vinny was a classic there, wasn't it? Culture clash.
I watched that when I was living in the South, and there were some things that they did too that was a little unreal, like the idea that, you know, what's his name, was it Joe Pesci, when he pulls up on a motorcycle, like anybody's going to look at him like he's strange. That seemed a little silly, you know, but a lot of it was a good funny movie.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and today I'm talking to Phil Campbell about his book on campaigning, and which we're establishing is a memoir of the campaign, in a way. So how close to reality is it? Grassroots? It's definitely grassroots. No AstroTurf visible or used in the making of this film or book. So is Grant Cogswell still talking to you? He's the candidate, by the way, listeners.
Yeah, Grant and I had a bit of a falling out. We're very, very, you know, we've got two pretty strong egos, I think, and he went his way and I went mine, and I feel like that was probably for the best, especially after living with, you know, I kind of went through this campaign, and if you read the book, it's like, wow, these guys went through so much together in 18, 20 weeks, it's insane, and then I wrote about the whole experience and kept having to talk to him about it and sort of relive it again and again and again, and I was sort of the beaten upon, you know, the martyr kind of campaign manager, and that's what a lot of campaign managers have to go through, is they have to emotionally support their candidate as well as logistically and organizationally. It's a real challenge. But Grant went off, and he's got a used bookstore in Mexico City. He kind of fled Seattle. You know, I mean, we just, you know, I think it's we're all civil to each other and everything, but we do our own thing. That's for sure.
Oh, a used bookstore in Mexico City. That is still your outtake.
Well, even weirder than that, he made a movie in the Pacific Northwest first. He sunk a lot of money. We went broke, sinking all this money into a movie about an H.P. Lovecraft adaptation called Cthulhu. It didn't work out too well. He ended up. It's more famous now. The movie is more famous now for the DVD commentary, in which he offers scathing commentary about how they messed up. It's actually been listed as watch it for the commentary on why they messed up.
But then he moved to Mexico City, and so he's a very colorful guy, and I always love talking to him.
Look that up. I mean, H.P. Lovecraft is eminently mess-upable.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, I mean he's a really fascinating guy. We just go our, you know, we're just two different temperaments entirely.
But you weren't worried at all, you know, because if you were publishing this book in Britain, I'd have the libel lawyers would have been all over it.
How so? They're tougher libel laws there, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, you're sort of quite rude about him on occasion. Affectionately so, I agree. But, you know, you're suggesting sort of defaults in character and demeanor that my eminent learned friends in London would definitely be on your case about.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, I mean,
I hope he's not listening. I don't want to get my
head. You read it, it's like it's my warts all over the place and my mess, my screw ups, and his screw ups. I mean, I kind of expose all of it, you know.
I've got to give you your due there. You are sort of very self deprecatory. You fess up to all your F-ups.
yeah. I had a couple more than a few people read him, like, man, you were a terrible campaign manager, weren't you? I mean,
well, you were the only one in town, I gather, from looking at his finance campaign and his motley crew of helpers.
It was finding people who was consistent volunteers for any. That's one of the things that gets involved. You get the, trying to keep volunteers going through a campaign, and it's one thing if it's like a issue based thing where everybody can go, okay, yeah, we're all against charter schools or we're all for this. But when it's a personality, when you're really trying to lift up one, like an individual, getting the people, you know, I mean, it's that guy. You're really promoting that person. So, you know, keeping the volunteers going, it's the candidate's personality has to do a lot to keep everybody excited. This is a local campaign, so we just went through so many volunteers because, hey, can you do this? Can you do this next week? Can you do this tomorrow? Can you put in 10 hours this tomorrow? No, I've already done 3 hours, so I'm done. That kind of thing. It happens, you know. I mean, that wasn't the first time, but I mean, getting into that was one of the huge challenges of the whole thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, the alternative to volunteers, of course, is getting large corporate checks from
light
rail builders who will finance your campaign for you.
Oh, we were outspent, and that was a big reason why, you know, that we didn't win. I mean, that's a story, and I don't know, this is kind of a spoiler alert about that. I mean, the story, the point of it is not really win or lose. It's the idea of what idealism is, and just the rolling along of all of it. But you know, we were outspent, you know, 3 to 4 to 1. So, you know, we did the best that we could, and a lot of it was, you know, we tried to get that momentum of the grassroots and get the volunteers. 9/11, and this happened in 2001, so 9/11 plays a role in all of it. And it was an interesting thing.
I love the idea of you going home after 9/11 and sending out an invite for a pub crawl.
Yeah. Yeah. 9/11 really changed, you know, so many people in New York, and I live in New York now, obviously people in New York have a very powerful 9/11 story, many of them to tell. But when you're out, you know, the idea of 9/11, when you're not there, when you're 2,500 miles away, there were some weird reactions, and especially in a liberal city like Seattle, it felt like there were so many layers to people's reactions, and it really kind of, you know, people stopped, you know, 9/11 just stopped everything, and no one had the energy for any kind of grassroots politics or anything like that. And we were trying to make the argument that, you know, now is the time, you know, the terrorists win if we don't stay in a democracy, stay fighting in a democracy and stay involved as a democracy. But you know, really killed a lot of the momentum that we were hoping to build, we're building on the campaign.
It did some strange things. I was actually living down in South Street at the time, so I was marooned there, and I was reporting for Canadian Broadcasting early in the morning on my cell phone from under the FDR, and I suddenly was approached by a demonstration of the homeless in solidarity.
Oh, really?
With the 9/11 fighters. All the homeless who lived under the bridge and under the FDR, they actually mounted an impromptu patriotic parade, which
wow.
is one of the most bizarre
wow,
things
that...
I've ever seen.
Wow, that had to have been surreal. Oh, well, interesting.
Yes, I was wondering, and I know I didn't take anything last night. I know I didn't. What is it? Yeah. It was funny, one of them was a Cockney as well. It's just one of these bizarre things. He heard me speaking on the phone. He came up and said, "Hey, mate, got a fag?" And I thought, yes, a fag there. Cockney homeless guy under the FDR the day after the cataclysm and apocalypse. No, it's strange world.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the point, I mean, you know, because your campaign, the grassroots campaign you ran, was sort of bizarre enough to read like a novel because of your concatenation of characters in there, wasn't it?
Well, I felt like it, and that's what, you know, like, it wasn't just the fact that, hey, I got fired from my job, and I'm sort of, you know, like, oh, woe is me, and look, we ran this campaign. It was, as a writer, I saw that there was something there because there was a shape to how things played out, and it wasn't, you know, it was disappointing to me that the director Stephen Gyllenhaal took out the housemate who was really trying to do that silly lobbying against me inside the house, because, you know, I felt like he was the, you know, it wasn't just Grant, the campaign, it wasn't just Seattle, it was the fact that this guy after 9/11 lost his mind, and he was in the room next to mine, first watching hours and hours of CNN coverage, you know, as everyone else did, but then putting in Tarantino films, putting in Pulp Fiction, and, you know, and Reservoir Dogs,
and his newly acquired Glock, you mentioned,
and he bought a Glock, and we're 2,500 miles away, and he thinks we're going to have terrorist attacks, and he just was really on the edge. I mean, if there was a lawsuit there, I mean, I guess he would have been the person to file it, because it just, but it's all true. I mean, he bought a gun and was playing with it and kept playing with it, and the walls in the shared house were paper thin. I could hear it through the wall. I was trying to campaign. I'm trying to send emails. He's playing with a gun next door, and he hates my guts. And it's the thing. It's like, this guy, if he's going to lose and he's going to pull on me. And, you know, like, that's where this really got weird, and I started having my own breakdowns and all this stuff. It just, it became a very surreal story.
Well, it does, was it Sartre? Hell is other people. I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that part, has he read the book, seen the movie?
Has the housemate?
Yeah.
Totally, I can't connect. I totally can't find the guy. I mean, he kind of became a little bit of a drifter afterwards, because what happened was the other people we were six of us in the shared housing, and we're all very shaken by what he actually did when he did pull a gun on someone in the house the night before the election, over an election kind of joke. It was just bizarre. This was the circumstances, everything kind of coinciding in this way that was allegorical for me, which is why I wrote the book. But we all kind of lobbied the landlord, the owner of the house, to have him evicted, and he moved out the next month. We saw him once after that, never heard from him again. And I tried to track him down later, and I couldn't find him. He does not read books, so I never thought that'd be a problem. I tried to warn him about the movie, but then it turned out he wasn't being put in the movie. So, you know, who knows where he is? I hope he's come around and got stabilized from the state he was in before.
And learned how to put the safety on the Glock.
get rid of the thing. I mean, geez. I mean, he was a guy, you know, like, talk about characters. He cycled through all these hobbies. He would be obsessed with a hobby for a month, like the silly, like remote control cars that he would take out on the road and play with while traffic is streaming by. But then he'd get tired of that and he'd destroy that car, and he'd buy a mountain bike. But then he smoked cigarettes and drank a lot of booze, so he couldn't really ride a bike, and he gave up on that. And he built a computer in his room, but then he got mad and threw it out of the house, like up the second floor window. He had you know, that was short-lived. Then he had piranhas, and he loved to show us how the piranhas would eat other fish. I mean, he just kept going.
That's the funny thing. If you invented a character like this, the editor would probably tell you, you know, this is a bit too fantastic. You've got to tell
it's too insane.
It's real.
But it was he kept doing these things. He was a minor version of the candidate himself. He was sort of like the ADD version of the candidate, who had his own sort of obsessions and fervor. Grant had these passions and beliefs that were a little fantastical because, you know, he had this belief that if I step in time in this moment and for this campaign, the universe will align and everything will come together. And Grant had the stamina to make it through the campaign. You know, nothing that the housemate could have done. He would have given up after a couple of days. But they were sort of weird mirror opposites, positive negatives of each other about these obsessions and passions.
So this seems... on the face of it, a municipal election in the wettest part of North America with its eccentricities seems a very strange thing to be optioned for a movie anyway. How did that come about?
Well, I think that the director, Stephen Gyllenhaal, who's the father of Jake and Maggie, he got really attached to the Grant Cogswell character and the idea of the Grant's romanticism. And Stephen is an older guy in his 60s, and he lived through the 60s, and he had still a 60s activist spirit in him, and still does. And I love him. I think he's a great guy. I think Stephen Gyllenhaal is a great guy. He felt like he was an honest professional and all that, but he was consumed by the Grant Cogswell character and what he wanted to do. You know, he took a different tone. He took the same story, made it a little bit more inspiring than, you know, a Glock wielding maniac at the end. You know, made it, you know, threw in a love story, and, you know, everything has a sort of a welling of inspiration at the end versus what I did, which was sort of a downbeat, you know, almost like a, you know, one of those Russian novels where you just this stuff just keeps happening to the poor fellow, and it's just too bad, you know. Yeah. But you know, we had different tones and style, but you know, that story is very elastic and it has a universality. You know, local politics happens everywhere.
Yeah. Well, I sort of got 1 minute to go, but one of the characters who should be mentioned was not actually in the novel as such, but as a footnote, is Marion Zajonczyk.
Yes,
he's surely the subject for a future book. This guy's fascinating.
Not in the movie either.
Playboy.
Exactly. Not in the movie. In the book, a patron saint, which is why the dark tone, the dark clouds. But Zajonczyk, charismatic young man in his 30s, elected the same year as Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a zealot, a hardcore lefty.
Zealot, the great stuff. Yes.
He was hardcore left, and he wanted to move the New Deal farther than FDR would do, and he pushed, and he worked, and he worked, and he worked, and he went insane. And the story of his insanity is fascinating, gripping. He ended up killing himself with a suicide, like a martyr's suicide note that said, "I tried to change the world, but," and then left off.
Look,
before
we're coming up now. I see a future book in there. If you don't, somebody else should. This is
absolutely
Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and it's been my great pleasure to talk to Phil Campbell about his book Grassroots, now a movie as well. Check them out, people.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And this is the last Saturday evening broadcast of Catskill Review of Books for WJFF listeners. From next week, from Friday the 22nd, the show will be broadcast at 3:30 in the afternoon on Friday afternoons. Any of you have any suggestions for authors or potential subjects, please email me at catskillreviewofbooks@igc.org.
Listen in next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.